From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with former White House advisor David Gergen about his work with Presidents Nixon, Reagan, and Clinton, and what it's been like to cross over to journalism and face the political spin techniques he helped perfect. He's written a new book called Eyewitness to Power. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Electric Waco Chair, the new CD by the Chicago-based band The Waco Brothers. One of the band's leaders is a founding member of the British band The Mekons. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The major party presidential candidates campaigned today in key states. In Detroit, Republican nominee George W. Bush told veterans that if he's elected, he'll work with Congress to make sure military personnel are well-treated, well-housed, and well-paid. He cautioned that the U.S. military should not be used in place of diplomacy.
We can't try to be all things to all people. We cannot substitute our military for difficult diplomatic missions. We can be peacemakers, but we should not try to be peacekeepers all over the world.
The Democratic presidential nominee, Al Gore, campaigned today among factory workers in Pennsylvania. He told workers at a factory in Carbondale that his economic plan will help the middle class while boosting the U.S. economy.
I'm not satisfied. I think we can do a lot better. We've got to do a lot better. So I say you ain't seen nothing yet. We're going to do a lot better. We're going to make our economy stronger and better for middle-class families, for working families.
Vice President Gore in Carbondale, Pennsylvania. Gore won the endorsement of the Teamsters Union today. World leaders at the UN Millennium Summit focused today on the problems of Africa. Leaders from sub-Saharan Africa called for the help of the international community in combating AIDS, the leading killer in the region, and educating young Africans. Others called for a greater commitment to ending conflicts, including the wars in Sierra Leone, Congo, and between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Today, the heads of state from the 15 Security Council member countries held an open council meeting on peace and security in the next century. Union leaders and school district officials in Buffalo will meet later tonight for talks aimed at ending a teachers' strike that began today. Mike McKay reports from member station WBFO.
School and union negotiators are still at odds over wages and health care concessions. And this afternoon, school district lawyers asked a state judge to enforce an injunction he granted forbidding the teachers to strike. Teacher John Lehner walked the picket line today with more than 900 other educators.
We teach the kids that there's consequences for actions. Well, we're going to face the consequences of our action. We all realize that, and we're still here.
The teachers stand to lose 2 days' pay for each day on strike and could face jail time for defying the injunction. Teachers last hit the picket line back in 1976, resulting in a 30-day jail sentence for union leaders. It's uncertain if the 3,800 teacher workforce will carry out a district-wide strike again tomorrow or target specific schools with job action. For NPR News, I'm Mike McKay in Buffalo.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 51 points to close at 11,259 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq gained 84 points, or 2%. This is NPR News. House Republicans failed today to override President Clinton's veto of a bill that would have phased out federal inheritance taxes. Supporters of the tax repeal fell 14 votes short of the two-thirds majority needed to pass the measure over the president's objection. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe is concerned about hundreds of thousands of ethnic Hungarians living in Yugoslavia. Stefan Boss reports from Budapest.
The OSCE's top envoy for minorities, Max van der Stoel, arrived in Budapest at a time when 350,000 ethnic Hungarians in the neighboring Yugoslav province of Vojvodina are facing new problems. Last week, Hungary summoned the Yugoslav ambassador to Budapest to explain why the authorities have begun taking off the air Hungarian television channels in Vojvodina. Hungary also complained that a disproportionate number of ethnic Hungarians are enlisted in the Yugoslav army. But OSCE Commissioner van der Stoel warned that as long as President Slobodan Milosevic remains in power, the situation will not improve.
I think also about the difficulty to make progress here as long as the present regime in Belgrade persists.
Hungary is the only NATO country bordering Yugoslavia. For NPR News, I am Stefan Buss in Budapest.
Police in Colombia have seized what they say is an unfinished submarine that was being built for use by drug smugglers. Colombian authorities showed the 100-foot vessel to reporters in a warehouse in a mountainous town outside Bogota. They say the hull was found with documents in Russian, and police said there was also evidence that Americans may have been involved. A U.S. drug enforcement official said the vessel could have had the capacity to ship as much as 200 tons of cocaine. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Gergen has helped create presidential politics as we know it today. And he's crossed over to journalism to analyze and comment on politics. In his work as a White House advisor, he has helped presidents with their image, spin control, and putting their policies across to the public and the press. He started his political career as a speechwriter for President Nixon, eventually heading the speechwriting department. He went on to advise Presidents Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's now a political analyst for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS and ABC's Nightline, and he's editor-at-large for U.S. News and World Report. Crossing over from the Republican to the Democratic side and from White House advisor to journalist has given Gergen the reputation for flexibility and open-mindedness in some circles, but some people think of him as a traitor. Gergen has written a new book called Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership, Nixon to Clinton. I asked him if he sees the work he's done as a presidential advisor as being more about statecraft or stagecraft.
Well, they're inextricably linked, aren't they, these days? I would like to think it's mostly about leadership. That's the essence of it. And obviously, leadership requires statecraft. But since time immemorial, it's also required a degree of stagecraft. We like to think that, this is something new in the modern age. Well, in fact, George Washington, our first president, was very, very theatrical and understood. He loved going to the theater. And one of the most famous scenes out of the Washington's life was at Newburgh, New York, just after the war had ended, and his soldiers were quite restless. They hadn't been paid by the Continental Congress. And he was trying to put down a mutiny, and he appeared before his officers and took out a piece of paper, and then he took out his glasses. The officers had never seen him wear glasses before. And Washington said, I have grown old in the service of my country. And the officers all began crying. And he turned back the rebellion at that point. And everyone has understood since then, historians have pointed out, that was a bit of stagecraft on Washington's part. He was a terrific statesman, but he also understood stagecraft. So, yes, it is partly about stagecraft.
I think that there's some skepticism or even cynicism on the part of many people in the American public about political stagecraft now, because there's a fine line between using stagecraft to help a politician put across his message and using stagecraft to sell the public on sizzle when there's no stake. I'd like you to just comment about that, where you see that line as being, and if you feel that you've seen examples or participated in examples of both.
Well, it's a very good question, Terry. Let me just say this. We have had stagecraft from the beginning of the Republic, and indeed in all ancient Rome and ancient Greece there was stagecraft. I do think it's quite legitimate to have anybody in public life, especially in a democracy, become an advocate to promote their programs, to promote their ideas, indeed to promote their personalities, and particularly today when personalities seem to be such an important part of our national life. At the same time, there is something called excess. There is, I think, spin, for example, has gone way beyond what is appropriate for serious dialogue. And it's something that, because I was involved at one stage in the Reagan administration back in the early 80s, what was called the spin patrol. This was something it wasn't the beginning of spin, nor was it certainly wasn't the end of it. But I was involved in trying to promote Reagan's programs to the networks, for example, and to the national newspapers. So I became associated with what was called SPIN. And it's been one of my greatest regrets in public life is the degree to which, while I thought what we did in the early 80s was appropriate, I think it did help to open the door to what has become very, very excessive. So that now SPIN is no longer something that's associated just with programs, but it's become almost an art form of manipulation. And as Ben Bradley said, SPIN has become a polite way of saying lying. So I think it's in that sense that it's become excessive and it needs to be curbed. And, you know, what Americans are looking for far more than we're having in our national dialogue is straight talk.
While we're talking about your work in the Reagan White House, Cindy Blumenthal had written a piece about you for The New Yorker in 1993, and he described you as making the president's hardline positions more palatable and less harsh. And then he quoted a former Reagan aide as saying, "If you hadn't had David Gergen there, you would have had a harsh image of Reagan, angry, in-your-face conservatism instead of the smiley face." Huh. What are your thoughts about that? Would you agree that Reagan's policies were hard line, and it was part of your job to make them more appealing?
I don't agree with that. Sidney and I have our differences. He's been working in the Clinton White House, as you know, and promoting Mr. Clinton in the last few years, and we've had some differences from time to time. What I do think is I very much agree with the thesis that Richard Darman, put forward in a book he wrote about the Reagan presidency. And it was in the title of the book was Who's in Control? And he made the argument that essentially Reagan's rhetoric was more conservative than the way he governed. The way Ronald Reagan governed frequently was to present his conservative position. Of course he was conservative. But then he negotiated with Democrats, and he often came more toward the center in the way he actually governed. And and I think one of the reasons that Reagan was so popular, and indeed, I think he was the best leader we've had since Franklin Roosevelt. I don't agree with all of his policies. I'm not as conservative as Ronald Reagan, but I do think he was the best leader we've had since Franklin Roosevelt. Was that he did have a contagious optimism about him. He did enjoy. He had a great faith in the future. He was part of that generation that Tom Brokaw has called the greatest generation, people who came through the Depression, came through the Second World War, and were enormously optimistic about this country's future. And I think that shaped his perspective and made him seem, and indeed he was, I think, a person that people related to very well. And that's an important part of who he was. What I think is wrong-headed, Terry, are the people who believe that somehow Reagan was just reading a script, that he was a dummy, he didn't know anything, and people were just scripting him from the outside. That's not what his leadership was about. His leadership came because he was a person of convictions. He believed these things. You might not agree with him on what he believed, but he'd held these beliefs for a long time, and he was very consistent, and he lived his message. He embodied his message. That's an important part of leadership.
Well, you say he had, strongly held beliefs, but you also write in your book that goodness knows Reagan wasn't perfect. He could be so dreamy and inattentive to detail that he allowed dramatic mistakes to occur. He had less curiosity about public policy than any president since perhaps the 1920s. I think it was part of your job to prep President Reagan for press conferences. What was it like to prep him, knowing that he didn't have much interest or much of a mind for policy, and that's part of what he was going to be grilled about at a press conference?
Well, he could be dreamy, and I wanted to be sure in this book to recognize that Reagan, like our other presidents, had great strengths and he had weaknesses. And what I've tried to do here is, as someone who had the privilege of working alongside four presidents, including one Democrat and three Republicans, I wanted to have a three-dimensional portrait, and I thought it was only fair to the reader to sort of say, here's the way I saw it. Now, others can disagree, but this is what I saw. And what I found, to go to your question about in prepping him, there were some areas in which he had enormous amount of curiosity, for example, taxation and the level of taxation or military preparedness. There were other areas in which he did not. There's a famous, a moment in the Reagan presidency when he saw his secretary, Sam Pierce, Secretary of Housing and Urban Affairs, and he said, "Good morning, Mr. Mayor." So there were times when he could be a little bit removed, and I think that's why Reagan was a very good leader, but is not a model in every respect. In preparing him for press conferences, what he was interested in, Terry, was getting to the essence of issues and not so much all the details. He did not think that a president should be sort of the commander-in-chief of all details. He rather thought his job was to present the big picture and to make that the persuasive argument. And there were many instances in which that served him well. There were other instances in which it did not. That, in fact, I think that he paid a price himself when he allowed Jim Baker, his first chief of staff, to leave and swap jobs with Don Regan, who came over from Treasury. Don Regan had been president of head of Merrill Lynch, was a first-rate individual, but he was not cut out to be chief of staff. And so that there were essentially the whole Reagan presidency changed, and he was not as effective in the beginning of his second term, and also had the scandal of Iran-Contra because he wasn't paying sufficient attention to exactly who ought to be right there with him.
I think a lot of people wonder how can the same person work for President Reagan and President Clinton in trying to put their policies across to the American public when their policies and what they stood for politically is so different. So I'm wondering, what is it like to serve presidents who are so different in the policies that they represent? Do you feel as a presidential advisor or a communication, the White House communications director, that it's your job to believe in the policies that you're putting forward or only to do your best in representing the president of the United States?
Well, I think it's a combination of those two things. But there were times, I must admit, after serving in three Republican White Houses, when coming into the Clinton White House, I began to realize what it was like to be a liver transplant. And the body takes sometimes, and sometimes it does not, this strange entity coming in. Let me just put it this way. I had worked and was proud to have served in the Reagan administration. I worked for him for 3 years. I thought when I left the Reagan administration that was the last I would do of public service. I entered journalism, became editor of U.S. News and World Report, and had some other wonderful experiences. I've been very privileged in my life. When Bill Clinton was in trouble early in his presidency, when his as you remember, his presidency seemed to almost be derailed, he called me personally. I'd known him 10 years. I was not looking for a job. He said, "Look, I'm in trouble. I need help. Can you come in?" And I said, "Look, I'm happy to help you get your presidency back on track if I can. I can't stay. I don't want to be here for an election against Republicans. That would make me entirely uncomfortable. But there is a long and, I think, honorable tradition in this country of people from the other party helping presidents when they're in trouble. Many instances of people who did that were far more prestigious and had far more stature than I did. But I didn't model myself on them, but I hoped I was acting in that same tradition, and that is we only have one president at a time, and if that individual is having real problems governing and reaches out and asks you for personal help, I think you try to help him if you can. And I told him when I came in, there are going to be things in which we disagree, and I will not be able to stay if I find that I'm in total disagreement on philosophy, but if I'm in general agreement, and he, after all, when he called me, said, "I'm too far off to the left. I want to govern in a more bipartisan way. And one of the things I think you can help me with is not only forging better bonds with the press, but forging bonds with Republicans so I can work across the aisle with Republicans, and you can be helpful in that regard." I'm not sure how helpful I was in the long run, but I thought that was the right thing to do. And if he were to ask me again, I might, insist upon different circumstances and a different way of going about it. But I still think it's the right thing to do. I think that tradition ought to be a viable and a part of our American political tradition. I would hate that we'd ever see the day that, say, a John Kennedy, when he was elected, asked a Republican to serve as his Secretary of Treasury. He asked a Republican to serve as his Secretary of Defense. He asked a Republican to serve as his head of CIA, and he asked a Republican to serve as his national security advisor. In all four cases, Republicans agreed to take those jobs, and they came in and helped a Democratic president. And I believe that is a good and valuable tradition in American public life, and I hope it's one that continues.
My guest is political analyst and former White House advisor David Gergen. He has a new book called Eyewitness to Power. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Gergen. His new book is called Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership from Nixon to Clinton. In your new book, Eyewitness to Power, you share your impressions of the presidents that you've worked for, which is everyone from Nixon to Clinton. You started your political career as a speechwriter for Nixon when you were still in your 20s, and then you were promoted to running the writing and research team for the president. And you mentioned this really interesting exercise that President Nixon gave you when you were writing speeches for you. You say that each time you sent him a final draft of a speech, he asked you to underline the three sentences in the speech that you thought the press would quote. What was the point of the exercise?
Well, President Nixon, I don't think he was not very good at educating the country sometimes at what he was doing, for example, in Vietnam. I think he should have been far more straightforward about what was happening there. But he did take members of his staff in hand and try to help them understand how to do their jobs. And he tended to like—he liked to teach his speechwriters what to do. And so when I, at a fairly young and perhaps naive age, became head of his writing and research team, he did take me aside and say, look, you know, in your speeches, underline the three sentences you think the press will quote. And then we'll compare notes the next day to see what the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever, you know, may be quoting, to see what they've picked up. And the reason for that exercise was that you begin to understand through doing that, you know, time and again, and I made a lot of mistakes in the beginning, that the way the press covers a story is it's more like a narrative. They're not necessarily looking for what the president or a governor or a cabinet secretary may say. They're looking for something which is going to advance the story that's been in the press the day before. All of our you know, great controversies in public life tend to have a beginning, then they have a middle, and then they have a denouement, and then we move on to something else. That's the way narrative consists, and a lot of what we do in the press is a narrative. This big debate about the debates with George Bush and Al Gore. There's a narrative. So each day Gore says something or Bush says something, and they advance that story. And when you're inside government, you have to realize, what is it that they're going to pick up? What is they're going to run? Because that, in effect, it becomes your communication with the American people that day. And so you want to focus in and learn how to make a statement that can reach the public. After all, when you're elected president, your governing is not something you just hand down diktats from the top. You have to persuade people. You have to bring them along. You have to inform them if you're going to have a civilized democracy. And so it's important to realize, because the press is the medium through which you communicate, how one can communicate most effectively. And I learned through that, instincts of the press are, what kind of thing are they going to go for? And then you begin to hone in on those and try to make your point as effectively as possible.
Can you think of an example of a line that you wrote thinking that it would be quoted from the press, and you were right?
Well, in 1980, and I was only one of three architects of this, but in 1980, you remember that in the debate with Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan asked, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? Well, that was a line that we worked out for Dick Werthelin, who is one of his chief strategists and a very, very good political advisor, and the president and I sort of between us, and I try to explain this in the book, inserted into his closing statement in that famous debate with Carter, knowing that the press would pick that up and knowing that rhetorical questions have great power. You know that from your capacity to ask questions here, Terry, because you know how to— By framing a question in a certain way, you can expect a certain kind of response. Well, that's true of political leaders, too. So when Reagan asked, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, he knew that most Americans would say no, they're not. And that helped to solidify his support in that election. And he went on to win the election, of course.
One of the things that you did after temporarily leaving politics was to become the editor at U.S. News and World Report. You've also, of course, been news analyst for McNeil Lehrer and for Nightline. And I'm wondering, in your capacity as a journalist, what it looks like to you when you're listening to a speech and you know that somebody wrote this line expecting the press to pick up on it. Are you any more or less likely as a member of the press to pick up on that line that you know you're supposed to be picking up on?
I think that one has to be sensitive to whether you're being manipulated in one sense, and that is if you think the line is misleading, or if you think it's wrongheaded, or you think it's somehow distorting the truth, then I think it's very important to not, either not run it or to run it with a big qualifier and say, you know, this is where, you know, here's a reality check, just as the newspapers do so, like the New York Times now runs a real reality check on advertising, about political advertising, and they say, you know, here's what the facts are that goes with the, go with the ad. I think that's extremely important to do. But do I feel that when a political figure uses a catchy line, that somehow I shouldn't quote that? No, I don't. When Jack Kennedy asked, or John Kennedy asked when he was being inaugurated, ask not what you can do for yourself, but ask what you can do for your country, that was an enormously quotable line. I think the press was totally proper in picking it up. It's one of those memorable lines that lives on through history. And that's what political argument is. And what, we shouldn't be so scared of political figures using political argument to open our hearts or minds to the proposition they are putting forward. And listen, speech writing has a long and honorable tradition in this country. Richard Brookhiser points out in his biography of George Washington that when Washington was trying to give a, when he was getting ready to give a public speech, he could turn to James Madison and Thomas Jefferson for suggestions. He then had Alexander Hamilton draft up a speech for him, and he could send it back to Jamie Madison for a rewrite. That's a great team, by the way. We've never seen anything like it since. But I think it emphasizes that right from the beginning of the Republic, presidents from Washington forward have understood that in a democracy, it's very important that leaders communicate persuasively, effectively, candidly, truthfully with the public.
David Gergen has written a new book called Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership, Nixon to Clinton. Gergen will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Saab, featuring an all-turbocharged lineup, with safety features like the Saab Active Head Restraint System. SaabUSA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of the novel The Man Who Ate the 747 by Ben Sherwood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, working for President Nixon during Watergate, we continue our talk with David Gergen. And Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the Waco Brothers, a band which plays a citified variation of country rock.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Gergen. He's been an advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton, specializing in communications and spin control. He's now a political analyst for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS and ABC's Nightline. His new book is called Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership, Nixon to Clinton. You write in your book that Nixon, who you work for, had no compunction about lying to the press. Of course, Watergate is a good example of that. What was it like for you to, be communications director?
No, at that time I was in speech writing. I had very little contact with the press. And I must tell you, it was a real shock for me and for many of my colleagues and friends in the Nixon White House when the cover-up came apart, when it flew apart, because there were many of us who believed what Nixon was saying was truth. It was the truth. We had no reason not to believe him, and we were told every day by Bob Haldeman and others that what the president is saying is true, and that Kay Graham is just out to hang him. And of course, you learn later that Kay Graham was not out to hang him, and she's indeed a very, very honorable woman at the Washington Post, and that the people we were working for were lying to us. That was a great shock to a lot of us.
When did you figure out that you were being lied to?
That's a good question. I write in the book that the cover-up worked better inside the White House than almost any place else I can think of, because there were a number of there who were young, who idealized public life, who wanted to believe, even as the signals, even as the evidence started to pile up. We knew there was something rotten in Denmark, but we wanted to believe it did not extend to the top. Gradually the news got tighter and the people around the president increasingly were caught up, and it became obvious that people in the White House at first were involved, and then it became obvious that higher-ups in the White House were involved. But it didn't become clear until right toward the end that Richard Nixon himself was at the center of the cover-up. I remember very, very clearly just a few days before he resigned, Al Haig, who was chief of staff, called a group of us in who were department heads, and revealed to us then the existence of the so-called smoking gun tape and the contents of that tape. And that's when it first hit all of us. My God, he actually did this. It was a really a stunning moment. There was, I think, on all of us, there was a sense of shock and a sense of betrayal. And then it was over. It was it was obvious that he then had to leave, and he left a few days later.
Were you relieved when it was over and he resigned?
I went through just a really awful set of emotions. I was relieved. I thought it was right that he left. I welcomed Jerry Ford and his wife Betty to the White House. I felt deep sense of anger about what President Nixon had done to the country by dragging us through that long period of Watergate. Because I knew him and knew his vulnerabilities, I also felt very deeply sorry for him. I felt there was a real sense of tragedy about this. It was very Shakespearean, and so there was a mixture of emotions, and it took me a long time to recover from that. But I did come back. I don't think Richard Nixon can ever be forgiven for Watergate. I did come back to respect him for the rest of who he was. Richard Nixon was a very complicated man. And I think it's important to understand people as three-dimensional. Sometimes we on the outside like to see people as all good or all bad, or, this is the person who wears a white hat or that person who wears a black hat. My experience on the inside has been that people are a mixture of a lot of very good things and some bad things. And Richard Nixon had demons in him that took control of him, and he couldn't control them. And that's what they knocked him out. And that's what the tragedy is. But I think from that experience, it's important to understand, and that's why in the book I've tried to stress so much, that in choosing leaders, we shouldn't be looking just for the most talented man or the brainiest man. Richard Nixon was very talented, and he was very smart. But there was a serious problem in his personality. And that's why it's important to understand the character and the integrity and the way people are people well-centered. Do they have a real sense of a democratic tradition? I think that, as I write in the book, to a large degree, I think Nixon confused power and leadership, and power. It was a sort of a European sense. He would have been a great Metternich in a society in which he didn't have to answer to the people. But in a democracy, you have to answer to the people. And I think Richard Nixon did not fully appreciate the democratic tradition.
For a while, it was some people suspected that you were the deep throat who spoke to Woodward and Bernstein. I know you did share some information with Woodward. You write that in your book. Were you flattered or insulted during that period when some people thought you might be deep throat?
Well, I was. I guess a lot depends on what you think about deep throat. I am no fan of deep throats. I did not think that deep throat acted in an honorable way. I think if you have information that there has been wrongdoing or skullduggery or criminal activity in the government, rather than going to the press, it's best to take it to the Justice Department and to the authorities. And so I felt that I did not think deep throat acted in an honorable way. So when I was accused of being deep throat, or people suggested I was deep throat, I was not flattered. I was rather horrified by the prospect of it. But you know, that's the way it is. That, and Len Garment, who has just written a book, of course, making an argument that someone else, he considered me a candidate, and he considered a number of other, about 20 other people. And when I sat down and talked to Len, and we went through it, and I think he came to the conclusion that I was not in a position to know those facts. I had gone to school with Bob Woodward. We went to Yale together. He was behind me. I was a little ahead of him in classes. But I first met him in Washington, and he did call me in 1973, 1974, and he records this in the books he wrote with Carl Bernstein, that he would call me periodically when he was being stonewalled at the White House by everyone. He would call and say, look, here's the story we're working on. Can you help to find someone we can talk to? And when I first got that call, I went to Len Garment and to Ron Ziegler and said, yeah, Bob Woodward's calling. Here's what his issue is. Here's his problem. What do we do? Is there somebody here? We'll talk to him. And I then, with their understanding, brought Bob in a back door at night to see Len Garment in his office to talk. And Len, I think, gave him a White House perspective, and Bob went on his way. I happen to think, Terry, that that's the way government should operate, that when government is being accused of wrongdoing, that people inside have a responsibility to be accountable. And all of their public life should be a matter of public record. I think we go way too far today in invading the private lives of individuals. But in government life, I think it's really, really important that there be full accountability, and that everything be out in the open as far. And we insist upon that, especially when there are accusations of wrongdoing.
I'm forgetting the name that Leonard Garment says was really deep throat.
Leonard Garment accuses or says that deep throat is John Sears.
That's right.
Who was Reagan's campaign manager in 1980 for a period of time. John Sears has vehemently denied that, and notably, both Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward have said it was not John Sears.
And your opinion is?
I don't know who it is. I think it was someone. I do think there was a deep throat. I know enough about Woodward and Bernstein and their reporting to know that they would not simply make that up. I just don't believe that. But I think it was likely to be have been someone who was either in the intelligence field or in the investigatory field, because someone had to have access to an awful lot of FBI records and be privy to the investigation that was going on to be able to pass on that kind of really very, very sensitive investigatory information.
But you don't think it's John Sears?
I do not think it was John Sears. I think it was someone who had a motive. I don't know what the motive was. There was, as you remember, back in those days, there was a lot of tension between some people in the intelligence field and the White House over Vietnam. And I wouldn't at all be surprised if the whole deep throat story is somehow tied to the Vietnam War.
My guest is political analyst and former White House advisor David Gergen. He has a new book called Eyewitness to Power. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. David Gergen is my guest. His new book is called Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership, Nixon to Clinton. You worked briefly for the Clinton administration. The president called you in when he was getting a lot of negative coverage and having trouble putting across his policies. This is actually one example of the kind of trouble he was in. He had that haircut on the airplane.
Yes,
that,
right.
That held up traffic at the L.A.
airport. $200 airport. $200 haircut.
Right. And an example of the kind of bad... Bad coverage he was getting. Anyway, so you were called in. You write in your book that when you left the Clinton White House, you felt used. In what way did you feel used?
Well, I felt that this is a sensitive subject. I felt that I was brought in to help get the team back on track. And that when the team did get back on track, and by the way, the person who was really responsible for getting the team back on track was not me; it was Bill Clinton. Our effort on the team was to help provide a safe environment in which he could recover his self-confidence and rediscover his own strengths, and that's what he did. But once he was back up on top, that there was a the younger member of the staff and. Who resented my presence there as someone who obviously had worked for three Republicans in the past, turned on me with some venom, and while I'm old enough now to appreciate why these things happen, it was no fun, and I felt I got very little protection during that time from the president, and that I got knocked around more than I really thought was fair. And so I felt, listen, I came in, I gave up a lot. I took a lot of risks to come in here to do what I thought was right. And again, I said I continue to think it was right and would do it again if asked under the right circumstances, if the president were in deep, deep trouble. But having done that, having put a lot at risk, having given up a wonderful partnership with Mark Shields on McNeil Air, having left my magazine U.S. News, having given up, having sort of burned some bridges back in journalism, I thought, frankly, I deserved a little more protection, and so be it. That's politics. And, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Listen, I was bitter for a while, but I think you have to grow up and be appreciated. As you get older, Terry, as you have to realize if you're gonna step into turbulent waters, you're likely to get wet.
In one of the great ironies, when you were brought into the Clinton White House, it coincided with. The demotion of George Stephanopoulos, and now you and Stephanopoulos are kind of partners or counterparts on a Nightline. You're on all the
yes.
time together,
yeah.
weighing in on the latest political events.
Right.
So, I'm wondering what it's like for you and he to sit opposite the table from each other all the time.
Well, it's good to be on the same side. We were on opposite sides a lot during the Clinton years. One of the reasons I felt burned about going into the Clinton administration the way it happened. Was that I very, very much did not, when they asked me to come in and they told me that George was going to be changing jobs, I said, would you please get George's change made before I get there? Because if I'm associated with his change, he has dozens and dozens of people in that staff who love him, who they looked up to him, they worshipped him. And if I'm associated with that change, they're going to automatically see me as the enemy. It's going to really make my job much more difficult. Well, of course, the two of us got squeezed into the same announcement. And as we've pieced the truth or the facts together since then, we both were told different stories about what was happening and why that happened. So that he naturally, I think, bitterly, I think he was gentlemanly about it, but I'm sure he was bitterly resentful of my coming in there. So when we were thrown together like that, it just was hard. It was hard to be as effective as I wanted to be and under those difficult circumstances. So, but coming together with him now on Nightline, we have a lot of fun together. We put aside our differences, I think. We still, we disagree on policy. We disagree on a lot of philosophy, political philosophy. But I have enormous respect for George and Stephanopoulos, and I would like to think that he respects me.
So much has changed in the press since you were in your 20s and started working for the Nixon White House. It's particularly changed in the world of television, where now it's not just the three TV networks who are covering the news. You've got, CNN, you've got C-SPAN, who's like recording the whole speech, not just the sound bites.
Thank goodness for C-SPAN.
Well, I'm wondering how you think if the job of communications director or speechwriter has gotten any more or less difficult now that the TV press has changed as it has.
I think the whole process of governing is much more difficult today than it was 30 years ago.
And did we mention the 24-hour news cycle?
We didn't, but we should. I remember so well, Terry, when I left the Reagan administration, I could go out on the West Lawn of the White House in the mid-'80s, and you could count maybe five or six cameras out there. And then leaving the Clinton White House one night and going out on the West Lawn, there were 24 different cameras out there. All worrying at the same time. So it's changed dramatically, and I think it's made it much, much more demanding for those who work inside. And frankly, it's harder for a president to communicate well. What's happened is we don't have as many communal experiences as we once did as a people. Everything gets chopped up and soundbited, and you know, it's sliced and diced. So we see bits and pieces of things on various places, but we don't sort of have an experience together as a people in the same way. And I think it's harder for our presidents to reach us or to reach into our hearts. What Bill Clinton has done to offset this, and Michael Waldman has just written a new book. He was his chief of speech writing called POTUS Speaks. Michael Waldman was first-rate book. And what Bill Clinton has done is to give far more speeches than anybody else in history. He gives over 500 speeches a year now in order to keep, you know, to blanket the airwaves. But the problem with that is that if a president speaks that much, people get tired of it all. They start checking out. They don't listen to him at all. I think that in public communication, less can be more. That someone who speaks infrequently, say Alan Greenspan, he doesn't speak very often, but when he speaks, everybody listens. It's like E.F. Hutton. So I think that it's important in this new age of massive information but very little wisdom that our presidents learn to speak carefully, honestly, and not very often, and make their words count for more.
Well, David Gergen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Gergen has written a new book called Eyewitness to Power. This year is the centenary of the birth of the German-born composer Kurt Weill. The original American cast recording of his most famous musical, The Three Penny Opera, has just been reissued on CD. For this 1954 production, Mark Blitzstein translated Bertolt Brecht's lyrics. The cast featured Weill's widow and greatest interpreter, Lottie Lenya. The new CD has a bonus track featuring Lenya singing Mack the Knife, accompanied at the piano by Blitzstein. Let's give it a listen.
Oh, the shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. Just the jackknife has my keep, dear, and he keeps it out of sight. When the shark bites with his teeth, dear, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, where's my key, dear? So there's not a trace of red on the sidewalk. Sunday morning lies a body. Dropping down the cement just for the weight, dear. Bet your Mackie's back in town. Louis Miller disappeared, dear, after drawing out his cash. Have you noted Mackie's loan? Keeps it out of sight.
Varileña with Mark Blitzstein at the piano, a bonus track from the new reissue of the 1954 production of the Three Penny Opera. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the Waco Brothers' new CD. This is Fresh Air. The Waco Brothers are not brothers, but a Chicago-based band that likes to slip sharp social observations into its unique variation on citified country rock. The group's new collection is called Electric Waco Chair, and rock critic Ken Tucker says it continues the band's interest in simultaneously enjoying and critiquing its chosen form.
Listening to the tuneful, jangly, often quite chipper songs on the Waco Brothers' Electric Waco Chair, it's almost hard to believe that one of this band's leaders is a once-in-future Marxist-Dadaist proto-punk. That's John Langford, once a key member of the Mekons, a music collective from Leeds, England. Langford has always had his comic side, and he seems especially playful here, even when he's critiquing whatever they call yuppies these days in a song called Nothing to Say. But you may say, inveighing against the internet millionaire nouveau riche is like shooting fish in a barrel. And I hope that the second verse, with its swipe at 15-year-old singers with nothing to say, isn't aimed at that nice Britney Spears, who anyway is at least a few years older than that and whose belly button alone has much to say to millions of people. Langford and the Wacos understand this, as is made clear by the entertainment analysis provided on It's Not Enough, which, among other things, locates the death of rock and roll on the wreck of the Mary Celeste.
You can be the last one standing as the surface of the earth melts like a chocolate bar. Throw me out with the garbage, I'll never get that far. Bury me in the streets, scatter me like beads of mercury. Have me stuffed just like Twigger, a pickle for a souvenir. My pain is peeling, my nails all rust. At the peak of my popularity, I'm crumbling into dust. It's not enough.
Like most smart English musicians, Langford approaches American country and roots rock as alien territory. He doesn't feel comfortable personalizing his songs. You'll never hear him crying in his beer the way a hero like George Jones does, or pushing the formal boundaries of the music the way Willie Nelson does. Instead, Langford and his Chicago homeboys use the genre to tell stories, to make social observations, and to call attention to country music's commercial populist dichotomy. Remember, this album's called Electric Waco Chair, and their aim is to fry someone now and again.
His study is written by the winner. This is a loser's song. I took this job in the summer, never saw the winter rolling on. Never thought it would end in a second, a burnt out smoking wreck. Expectations and ambitions were just a rope around my neck. Broke my back to earn a crust, saw my dreams die in the dust. Now I'm walking on hell's roof looking at the flowers.
If you hear despair in lines like expectations and ambitions were just a rope around my neck, I'm here to direct you to a book of cartoons that John Langford drew and wrote with Colin Morton called Great Pop Things, The Real History of Rock and Roll from Elvis to Oasis, a fractured, hilarious, ruthless collection that joyfully messes with chronology, forcing Bob Dylan to lie down with Judas Priest. Go buy it and read it while listening to the Waco Brothers' musical but similar deconstruction of country rock.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the Waco Brothers' new CD, Electric Waco Chair. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross.
You know you can't stay here. The building will be raised in less than a year, and everything that it contains, the faucets, the stoppers, and the drain, will all seem like this.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From museumshop.com, an online boutique of products from museums around the world, including the Louvre in Paris and the British Museum in London. Museumshop.com. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, actor Morgan Freeman. He's starring in the new film Nurse Betty. Also, drag star Charles Bush, his play Psycho Beach Party has been adapted into a new film. He's also featured in the HBO prison series Oz. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.